Hear now the word of the Lord from Galatians 4, starting in verse 8. Formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those that by nature are not gods. But now that you have come to know God, or rather be known by God, how can you turn back again to the weak and worthless elementary principles of the world, whose slaves you want to be once more? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I am afraid I may have labored over you in vain. And thus ends the reading of the very words of God. A man named Jan Erik Olsen, you may have heard of him before, but in 1973, he escaped from prison. He grabbed his submachine gun, walked into a bank in Sweden, which was one of the wealthiest banks of Sweden. It would have been in the area of maybe what New York would call Zach's Fifth Avenue. There was Prada, Gucci, Louis Vuitton. All of them were around that area. He would go into that bank and he would take four hostages, three women and one man. And as he takes these hostages, something crazy took place. To one lady who was cold, he gave her a jacket and it made her feel warm. She's like, oh, you're such a nice man. To another woman was trying to make a phone call to her mom. She said, oh, he's so nice. He let me call my mom and help me with that. To another lady who felt claustrophobic, he tied a rope around her and he let her go 30 feet and walk around. And then he drug her back in and he says, how nice is he? He's letting me walk around. Now to the man, he's like, he was so kind. He told me he was going to shoot me in the leg. What a great guy. You know what this is called. It's called Stockholm Syndrome. Nowadays, the sociologists like to call it trauma bonding. The same person that harms you is the same one that rescues you. Or the very person that harms you is the one that brings you comfort. This is what idols do. They enslave you. They force you to do things. They tell you to do something. You're always working to them. But they give you this little tiny hit of dopamine. They give you a little bit back. They do give you breadcrumbs. You think about Corinth, and Paul talked about how idols had such perverted sexual practices in their worship. They would force you to do things that were against your conscience and against nature, and you kept doing them, but you got a little bit of pleasure out of them. Kind of like drug abuse and substance abuse. It does give you a little bit, doesn't it? Coming back for more and more and more. Maybe you've been on a cruise before. You meet these people in the casinos. And you know what they tell you? I won $2,800. And you're like, whoa, maybe I can win $2,800. They got a free cruise. Wow. They didn't tell you it cost them $10,000 to win it. They never mentioned that part. You see these people keep going back over and over and over and over again. And this is what these doctrines of demons do. They enslave you, but they give you just a little back so you keep coming back for more. And Paul wants to show the people in Galatia, you don't keep running back. Don't do this. And if you're taking notes, there's four things I want you to see. And they all start with S, by the way. Some of you like that. The first is slavery to idols. He's going to talk about this slavery to idols. The second thing I want you to see is seen by God. God sees you. The third point that I want you to see is this Stockholm syndrome, not to constantly run back to these false gods. And the fourth thing I want you to see is same picture. You've seen that meme before, right? The same picture. It's the same picture. So four things to start with an S: slavery to idols, seen by God, Stockholm syndrome, and same picture. And as we talk about the slavery to idols, I want you to understand what the community there in Galatia was like. You know this because you read it in the book of Acts, chapter 14. Paul is planting churches in Galatia in chapter 14, and he gets to this place called Lystra. And there in Lystra, they're very superstitious. They worship all these pagan gods. He's preaching the gospel, and this lame man, who was lame from birth. He couldn't walk. He was a beggar in the street. That's how he made his money. Wasn't capable of working. People would give him money. He hears the gospel and his heart strangely warmed. He's like, ooh, Jesus is the only way. I like that. And God changes his heart. He calls out to God. He comes to know the Lord. And Paul looks at him and says, you know what? Now that you're a believer, I want to authenticate this message a little more. And he heals the man. You know, the apostles had that superpower. He healed the man. Now he's like, okay, now people will finally listen to the message. This will authenticate my message. This healing would. But instead of worshiping the one who healed, which was ultimately God, instead of listening to the message, instead of authenticating the message, they started worshiping the messenger. You've heard, don't kill the messenger. They started worshiping the messenger instead of what the message was, which was Christ came to die for you on a cross. They worshiped him. As a matter of fact, not only did they worship him, they started worshiping Barnabas. They said, Barnabas is Zeus. Paul is Hermes. And they started going to the temple of Zeus, and they were bringing these elaborate sacrifices of oxen and animals. And Paul and Barnabas is saying, no, you don't worship us. They said, we don't care. We want to keep worshiping you. And then you continue to read, the people from Jerusalem caused a problem there. But you see the heart of these Galatian people. They were surrounded by false gods, just not one, but many, many, many gods. This is what they believe. So much to the point where there's what? Even if you go to Athens, there was a temple to the unknown God, just in case we miss one, right? You don't want to throw that one off anywhere. And Paul is saying what in verse 8 here? Formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those that by nature are not gods. Paul makes this clear in 1 Corinthians 8:5. There are so many gods, right? I mean, Zeus does exist. Baal does exist, but they're not gods. They're fake. They're false. They do nothing for you. And all they do is demand, demand, demand. And how do they get you? How do they get you by the claws? Well, they enslave your conscience with fear. They would tell the Galatian people, these false gods would, that if you leave, your children will die. Your wives may have miscarriages. You'll never get rain. You'll never be provided for. And they demand more and more and more. Even sometimes they would sacrifice their kids to a false god. And then they're thinking, well, I can't go back now. I look like an idiot. I've already killed my kid over this. So it gets you and you keep going back and going back and going back. And the karma just more and more and more. But see, it gives you a little bit of pleasure too, doesn't it? Do you remember in the 80s, some of you millennials go, I remember that shirt. You weren't there, but you wear the shirt that said DARE, right? Keeping kids off drugs. Nancy Reagan was all about DARE. I remember in elementary school, I was always told the drug dealer is going to give you your first hit for free, right? And get you, bring you in so you get addicted to it. And I don't know if that's true or not. There's a couple of police officers here. I'll ask their opinion on it, or you can. But you know who does give you the first hit for free? Satan. Oh, he makes that first sin look so luxurious, doesn't he? Oh, he paints it in such a good light. And sin is fun for a season. You can imagine you're in Corinth. You're having problems with your wife. You know there's a God and you go to the temple and there's temple prostitutes. I bet it's fun for a little while until you go home and your wife walks out of the house and your kids hate you the rest of your life. Right? They don't tell you that, do they? Then you get addicted to it. Or how many people are like, oh, it's fun for a little while, pulling the little sports gambling thing, right? Next thing you know, you're hooked and you're trapped. Idols are evil taskmasters. This is what they do. They get you hooked and then they want more and more and more and more and more. And they drive you to the brink of perishing forever. The perversion and the promises that they make are never true. And Paul is telling them, do you remember how you were enslaved to this? You couldn't get out of it. And then Christ comes. And he sets you free from this bondage that you had to these false idols and this enslavement to these false gods. Brings us to the second part of the sermon, seen by God. And I wanted to take a detour just to tell you what Paul does here. It's absolutely incredible in my mind. But I wanted to help you with what Paul is saying by talking about Islam. Some of you may understand that that's a different religion. And I want you to know that everyone believes in God. You've all heard that there's no atheist in foxholes. Absolutely true. Paul says, what can be known about God is plain to them. Everyone knows there's a God. Even the Muslims know that there is one God. They know that. They know who God is. But instead of trusting God and watching him, how he has revealed himself and looking at the word, they choose to create an idol. Now, the Arabic word for God is Allah. They create an idol and they worship this idol. Their idol is not triune as God has revealed himself. Three persons in the Godhead, equal in substance, power, and glory. There's one God, but there's three persons in the Godhead. There's this radical anti-Trinitarian thought within the Muslim faith. They hate the Trinity. They hate that. They have a radical oneness. They said they believe in the transcendence of God. And God is so transcendent, the entire religion is based upon your submission. Now, Islam isn't monolithic. They're different. And the closer you get to the Arab world, the more true Muslim they are. But all of them have this demand. And Allah demands that your moral laws, your dietary laws, your behavioral laws, you have to follow the hadiths. And they contradict each other because there's no context, which is another sermon. But they want all these things from you. And you know, the reality is, when Muslims are honest, they tell you, I can't keep them. I break them over and over and over again. And you ask, well, is there forgiveness? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Allah's capricious. He can change his mind. He can say one thing and then change his mind another. All he cares about is submission. And you get to the point where you have to show your submission and one up everybody else's submission and learn to hate really what Allah hates, which is the infidel. And you know where that goes in people's mind. So different than the God that loves himself. Do you understand the Trinity, how important this is? That God sits in the heavens perfectly with the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit and loves. He doesn't need your love, but he is love. The Father loves the Son. The Son loves the Spirit. The Spirit loves the Father with an equal unity. God is love. He doesn't need love. He is love. He just doesn't express love. He is love. And he is so loving that the incarnation is so important because God, the second person of the Godhead, adds to himself a body and comes to earth. See, he's just not transcendent. He's immanent. Muslims hate that. God can never be that close. No, there's no way he could be that close. He's so transcendent. No. Christ comes to earth in human form. See, his knowledge of you isn't just a head knowledge, it's experiential knowledge. He knows humanity. He knows everything about humanity. And look at verse 9. Paul says it here, but now that you have come to know God, or more technically or more important, he makes a qualification here, one of the greatest qualifications in all of the scripture. Not that you've come to know God, or rather to be known by God. Way more important. I know a lot of famous people. I can make a list of them. You may be wowed. But the truth is, they don't know me. They don't even know I exist. I actually had a friend who actually knew a U.S. president. He was a Marine, and he was at Camp David. And there at Camp David, he got to know this president very, very well. And there, when the president retired, whatever you call it, the second term was over, he had these book signings all over America. In the early 2000s, they had this book signing. And there were so many police in that city. There were canines, bomb dogs, there was everything. You could even walk a city block with another person having a metal detector checking you, Secret Service everywhere, thousands of officers, all hands on deck, the entire federal government, the state, the local, everybody was there, roped off. Not everybody got to have their book signed. It was probably like just whoever, select few. But there was a lieutenant corporal called out, just in a hoodie, jeans, in college, bring him to me. I know him. This little ragtag man got to meet the president. Yeah, they were loyal to each other. Interesting to think about. The president knew him. Way more important than you knowing who people are is people knowing you. I'm going to make some of you feel really old here. I felt really old when I thought about this. In 1996, this man named Tommy Walker wrote this song. Now, you know this song because it's been sung by three different people And in 10 years from now, someone else is going to redo it. You know how it works. It's called, He Knows My Name. You know the lyrics. I have a maker. He formed my heart. Before even time began, my life was in His hands. He knows my name. He knows my every thought. He sees each tear that falls. He hears me when I call. God knows me. He knows my name. And this knowing isn't just a head knowledge. Right? We talked about foreknowledge a week ago. This is a personal knowledge. A lot of you men know a lot of women, but you don't know them like you know your wife. You know them. You know them. God knows your name. He knows you. As much as the liberals want to say they love the Sermon on the Mount, they hate the end of the Sermon on the Mount. They want to make Jesus and Christianity out to be about being like Jesus. What is Christianity? Well, you got to be like Jesus if you're going to be a Christian, because Jesus was the greatest Christian that ever lived. Jesus wasn't a Christian. He never had to confess any sin. Christianity is a religion where your sins are forgiven. Jesus never one time had to confess sin. Oh, he was a great example. But when you get to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, verse 22 in chapter 7, Jesus says many people are going to say they know me. Many people are going to do many things in my name, like prophesy, cast out demons, and do mighty works. But this is what the Father will say. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Why? I never knew you. Way more important than you knowing God. Everyone knows God. Does God know you? See, the problem with the church in Galatia was they were thinking, well, I got to get the attention of God. Maybe I can what? Do like we used to do to the other gods. Do a lot more stuff and maybe they'll see us. No, God sees you based upon His Son. That's the only way you'll get to know God, is to be adopted by His Son, not by your works, by trusting in His finished work, which is the work of Christ on the cross. We've seen the first S, which is slavery. We've seen the second S, which is seen by God. And now we get to the third S, which is Stockholm Syndrome. And we understand it. The same person that harms you is the same person you go back to for your love and commitment and compassion and enjoyment. These idols had enslaved the people in Galatia. And look at what we see at the end of verse 9. How can you turn back again to weak and worthless elementary principles of the world, whose slaves you want to be once more? How can you go back to the very thing that enslaved you, that forced you to do things that was against your conscience, that forced you to do things that you didn't want to do, things that ruined your life? How can you go back into that enslavement? Do you remember the Israelites did the same thing? Moses had already went to Pharaoh, let my people go, and the plagues, and they go out and they're in the wilderness. And it got a little scary in the wilderness, didn't it? They had to live. There was no more time schedule, no more do this, do that. It was scary. The unknown was scary. At least in Egypt, we knew we were going to get that little pile of food. Here, we don't know where we're going to get our food from. At least in Egypt, we knew what time we were going to go to bed. I mean, he did give us 4 hours of sleep a night, right? At least we knew. They wanted to go back. Sometimes this slavery to idolatry is a better option because it's a lot less scary than the unknown world. So you go back to the checklist and the checklist and the checklist of the do's and don'ts. My wife's father loved cherry jam. That was his jam. That's my joke for today. Right? Love cherry jam. And you can only find this cherry jam in the Midwest at the Amish store. Now, for those of you who don't know, she grew up around the Amish store, and there's some in Pennsylvania, the Amish store. I am on strict orders not to ask questions while walking through the Amish store. Danielle looks, no questions, because I'm like, well, if they don't have electricity, how they build all this stuff? It's incredible. Looks like they came from China. Don't ask questions, Travis. Just enjoy the Amish store, okay? I'll just enjoy the Amish store. But there in her little hometown, right up the road, this Amish man named Leonard and his wife Dora May had been reading the Bible, and they come to realize that it wasn't a checklist of doing things, but it was Christ and Christ alone that saved them from their sins. And they said, you know, I don't think we're doing it right. And the elders of the community shunned them. They were kicked out. And let me tell you the worst thing that happened. They were no longer able to sell the cherry jam. Right? Whoever distributed the cherry jam no longer brought it to them. They were without cherry jam. They got it from somewhere else, probably wrapped it the same thing. I don't know how they get it. I'm not supposed to ask questions. But one of the things he realized when he was excommunicated was that a tractor does a much better job at plowing a field than a horse. He got himself a tractor and a backhoe. He loved it. There's videos about how much he goes, you got to understand how massive these tractors are. They do so much more work. Then he's like, I got myself a Toyota Sienna. 2006. He goes, I can take my wife and people around in the car. It's amazing. It's like a whole new world to him. My clothes. Look at the colors I'm wearing. They're great. Then he said, electricity is so amazing. You don't have to run generators or anything. You just plug right into the wall and it comes up. It's like the city brings it to you. How crazy would it be for him to say, oh man, but now I have to pay my electric bill. Never had an electric bill before. Gas prices are really high right now. I'm just going to go back to that old lifestyle because gas prices are too high. Where am I going to get my next paycheck to provide for my family? Why go back to the slavery? At least you have a little bit of control, right? Got a little bit of control. That's the one thing that these enslavement gives you, is a little bit of control. Well, I can't completely trust God. He may send me to Africa to be a missionary. You know, there's no air conditioning where the weeks are, right? What if you have to eat bugs? No accoutrements? Some of you may say, I have a pool membership now. What am I supposed to do with that? I have to fulfill my, you know, agreement to be a part of the pool membership. God may require something even more radical of me than going to Africa. Forgiving someone who has offended me and hurt me. Or he may ask me to share the gospel with my neighbor. I don't even like my neighbor. The radicalness of God. It's easier to have this checklist. And he says, why would you go back to these pagan principles? Slaves you were once were. Living by faith can be scary. Or is it just me that has to live by faith and is scary? Not knowing what God is doing, but trusting him, knowing he is a good God. Oh, Paul is saying, don't go back. Those idols enslaved you. Those false gods enslaved you. You don't understand how good your freedom is. We've seen slavery. We've seen seen by God. We've seen this Stockholm syndrome. And now we get to the last S, which is same thing. And this is really his bombshell. You could say it's his mic drop in verses 8 through 11. And I'm going against my better judgment here because I'm speaking about a television show. I don't typically do that. I'd much prefer to have books. But this scene that I'm about to speak of comes from season 7, episode 25 of The Office, The Search Committee. Pam pranks acting manager Creed by asking him to spot 7 differences between 2 similar pictures before telling the audience they're the same picture. And you've seen this meme before. Oftentimes they put a man and a crying baby next to each other. And Pam says, it's the same picture, right? Or you put a politician who's in one party and the politician's in another party. It's the same picture. They vote the same way. They do everything the same, but they say they're on different sides and they're really not. You've seen, it's the same picture. This is what Paul is doing here. He says it's the same picture. If you are worshiping demons, trying to appease a God by doing things, it's no different than you trying to do things to appease the God of the universe by keeping law. He says you're acting just like a demon. As a matter of fact, when you see this in the passage, whose elementary principles, right? If you remember 3 weeks ago in chapter 4, we saw this in verse 2. But he is under guardians and managers until the date set by his father. In the same way, we also, when we were children, were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. And when you look at commentaries, they say, well, it could mean darkness, demons, and demonic sacrifices. Why? Because Paul says elementary principles, whether you're keeping them to appease the God of the universe, right? They were supposed to drive you to the God of the universe. These laws were guardians to show you who Jesus was. They were supposed to drive you right into the arms of Christ. They were not supposed to be what saves you. Those elementary principles, the ABCs, are no different than the demons that you sacrifice to. You're both doing the same thing. It's the same picture. You're both trying to earn your salvation. You're both trying to placate a God. That's what you're doing. Paul is basically telling us that those judicial laws, those that were given to the estate of Israel, those in the times before Jesus Christ comes in the old covenant, they have been expired, is what he's saying. If you think the divines, when they sat down in the 1600s to write the Westminster Confession of Faith, if you thought they were making stuff out of thin air, they were not. They were taking scriptures and applying it to theology. Those laws that were created for Israel, God had to create a nation. With Abraham, remember, he creates a family. But with Moses and the Mosaic law, God creates a nation. You can't exist without laws. You can't exist without festivals, without days, and without holy days. God gives them this festival. But instead of looking at, okay, they're expired with the estate of Israel, they're not there anymore. Now they're thinking, we got to keep these to make God happy. That's the doctrine of demons. God is already happy. You don't do anything to make him happy. You just trust what he's given you. I knew I was onto something. I don't know if you've ever done this. You think you're right, and then you go to the commentary, and it says the same thing. You get excited. You're like, yeah, right? Now, Martin Luther, in his commentary, he said the same thing I said. Now, he did not mention the office, just so you know. But if he'd have seen the meme, I'm sure he would have mentioned it. This is what he says about Paul in verse 10. He says, therefore, it's all the same thing. Whether he afterwards turns again to the law or to worshiping idols, it is all one whether he be called a monk, a Turk, a Jew, or an Anabaptist. For when the article is taken away, there remaineth nothing else but error, hypocrisy, impiety, and idolatry. He's making his argument that Paul is doing the same thing. It's the same thing, whether you're a monk, Turk, Jew, Anabaptist, or someone worshiping idols. You know, Luther understood being a monk. The whipping of himself, the Hail Marys, the constant rigorous trying to appease God by what he did. Muslims, the same things with their halal, always trying to do more and more and more to show their submission. Or the Jewish person who goes about with his different pots and pans or buys a washing machine that has kosher mode. We got to make sure it's got kosher mode. Right, they're always thinking, I have to appease God because he's upset. Or even the Anabaptist, who were separatist, who says we don't drink, dance, or chew, or go with girls that do. Those are the Anabaptists, right? Those were the fundamentalists. All of them are doing the same thing as Baal worshipers that engaged in grotesque sexual practice to entice Baal so he would rain down blessings upon them. It's the same thing. It's no different. It's just people trying to appease God. And Paul is making the argument here that it is a slippery, slippery slope. We see it here clearly in verse 10. You observe days and months and seasons and years. You're mixing the two. It's a slippery slope. In chapter 5, verse 2, he says, you're not there yet, but you're about to make circumcision a way of salvation. Now listen, are you on a slippery slope? We all can get this way, thinking that we can garner some type of attention from God based upon what we do, or some type of right standing with God. I think of people in public school, isn't that a hot topic nowadays? You know, some people can't afford Christian school. They don't have the means to do so, and some people aren't good at homeschooling. Sometimes they have to send their kids to public school. Don't make that a mark of Christianity as if you're better than someone else. Or drinking alcohol. You know, people really do struggle with alcohol. And it's a real thing. Some people are addicted to it. Some people are addicted to substances. Some people are addicted to eating. We all have our different sins, right? But don't make that a mark of that you're a real Christian if you don't do it this way. Or maybe Christian nationalism. Some people are very pro it in this church. Some people are against it. I think they talk past each other, and that's my personal opinion. But at the end of the day, that's not a mark that, well, I'm the true Christian and you're not. Listen, you're not going to appease God by that. This world is passing away. You only placate the wrath of God by trusting in Christ. There is no checklist that you can have. You observe these days and months and seasons and start mixing these pagan religions with Judaism, there's no difference. Paul then goes on to say, I'm afraid that I may have labored over you in vain. Imagine that. Paul saying, I feel like my entire ministry may have been in vain. Because if you can't grasp that Christ and Christ alone is the only way to glory, if you can't grasp that the only way to placate the wrath of God is to see that Jesus Christ himself was the one that absorbed the wrath of God on Calvary, he who knew no sin became sin for us, and the Father turned his face away. If you can't see that, you've missed everything that I have given you. Let's not be like the church of Galatia and think a checklist can somehow make our God happier. As we close, I thought I would speak about Calvin. Calvin has this book called The Institutes of Christian Religion. In book 3, chapter 17, he has this really interesting thought about how God the Father is pleased. And you understand this. He says it like this. And how are people's actions deemed good as if there was no deficiency in them, just as the merciful Father indulgently pardons the spots, the blemishes which he hears of them? He's asking questions about what makes God happy. And it made me think of people who draw pictures. Like little kids will give their parents pictures. Little kids oftentimes on their bulletin draw pictures of me. And I got one picture one time and I looked at it and I had to confront the parents because I said, I think your kid's blind. And they're like, what do you mean? I was like, I'm not that big. No way. I don't take up the whole page. That's insulting. You know, I don't take those and throw them in the trash can and say, these kids... The reality is this, they're not Van Gogh, right? There's no Picasso sitting here drawing these pictures. Some of them are actually pretty good and talented. But you know when a little kid brings you something, you put it on your fridge, it means a lot, doesn't it? It means the world that a kid would draw a picture of me while I'm preaching. I put it in my office as a reminder of the kingdom of God. Calvin's making the same argument. How does God take our works that are so terrible? To us, we're like, there's no way I can please God. I'm a nothing. He's like, you're getting it finally. If you feel that everything you do for the Lord doesn't even compare, he goes, you're finally getting it. And he says, in one word, the only meaning and acceptance in this passage is that God accepts and takes pleasure in his children, in whom he sees the traces of his own countenance. You're like little kids drawing a picture to God. This is all I have is a fire engine. It doesn't look like one. And God's like, I know. Isn't it beautiful? I love it. Do more. Do more. We don't do things to appease God. We do them because we love him. We're his children. And they're very imperfect. God does things perfectly. But God looks down at his children and he goes, thank you for that picture. So every time your kid or someone gives you something, you post it on your fridge, or your kid's trying to do something and they don't do it well, you think about your works to God. He accepts them because you're his son. That's why he accepts them. Not because he needs to placate his wrath. He just loves you working for him and serving him. Let's ask the Lord to bless the preaching of his word as we prepare for the supper. Father, thank you for